Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Core Intuition, keeping your families warm and well-fed.
You know, if we put off releasing episodes for a long enough time,
mm-hmm.
then we could release them daily and pretend like we were a daily show.
But that would only last for like a week, and then we'd have to...
Yeah, but we could get a lot of venture capital in that week, and that would finance the development of future content.
Yeah, well, we could. I don't think that's going to work.
No? All right.
I'm trying just to blog every day, and that's kind of a challenge. The people that can actually do a podcast or a video podcast every day have my respect, because that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it makes you appreciate like Leo Laporte's Twit Network.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know he has some staff now helping out, and that must be a great, assistance. But you just think he must have a lot of the mechanics of recording and mixing down, and all the stuff you do. He must have that like back of his hand, easy as pie or whatever, you know.
So what you're really saying is that I do a terrible job of automating the post production process.
Well, hey, you're no Leo Laporte, right?
Oh, yeah, no, it's true.
If you were, then you'd be on video, television, podcast all week long, and I think we're both grateful that we're not in that position.
Right.
So, anyway, we wanted to mention soon, early in this podcast, so we don't forget like we did 2 weeks ago, we wanted to make sure listeners were aware of a new conference that's going on, put on actually by Scotty from the Mac Developer Network. And he is responsible for some really cool stuff. There's a series of podcasts that he puts out that are include like developer roundtables where a bunch of developers get together and chat about stuff. He also has taken over moderatorship of the Mac software business mailing list on Yahoo,
mm-hmm.
which is a valuable resource, which I don't know if we've mentioned it before, but you can find it by Googling Mac SB Yahoo, probably. The timely sort of news from Scotty over at the Mac Developer Network is this, I think it's a 1 day or 2 day. Let's see. I have the page right here. It's a short conference in April this year, the 16th and 17th of April. And it's in the UK, so it's maybe not particularly convenient for our American continental listeners. But for Europeans and especially people in the UK, it might be something to check out. There is a URL, macdeveurope.com, and you get all the details there. The summary is it's if you register this month, it's £399. Which I don't know is probably like $500 million or something.
Yeah.
It adds up to something fairly reasonable, especially when you consider it looks like you get a night's accommodation included in the price. So
yeah, it looks like a cool conference. I wish I could attend, but yeah, Europe is just a little bit too far for me this time, at least to justify a one-day trip especially.
Yeah.
But it looks fun. They have some good speakers, most of which I haven't heard speak before. A few people that are pretty well-known now and have sort of written a book recently or done a podcast or done something in the last couple of years where they're fairly well-known in the Mac community.
We've got Bill Dudney, who's an iPhone core animation author, expert. Matt Jimmel, who does a lot of open source cool stuff that he shares, Cocoa open source stuff. Mike Lee, the famous world's toughest programmer, formerly of Delicious Library. Graham Lee. Oh, we got the battling Lee cousins. Not really, but Graham Lee, actually, if we go back to our first episode ever of Core Intuition, when it was released, remember I was in England at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Probably around the time when this was released, I was actually having beers with Graham Lee and Scotty from the Mac Developer Network, Mike Abdullah from Carelia. So this is a
cool
England and Drew McCormack. I've seen him do some stuff with science. He's a science guy. I think he was using FlexTime actually for some kind of a vaguely lab related thing. Philippe Mougin. I don't know how to pronounce that. But what's that? That's the F-Script guy.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
I think so. I don't have it in front of me.
F-Script everywhere. F-Script.
Yeah. And Scotty had him on, I think, a Late Night Coco episode. It was where he went into a lot of new stuff in F-Script.
So that's cool. Andre Pang. I'm just going on and on, but I'm almost done here. Andre Pang is from Rapid Weaver. They met him at WWDC. Famous Fraser Spears of Flickr Export fame. And Marcus Zara, who is... guy does, I know he used to do the SE sales, but and he also works with our good friend here in Boston, John Trainer, on some stuff. So,
cool.
This is quite a lineup.
It's a good lineup. One of the things that struck me about it, too, is I wonder if this represents sort of an official kind of turning point in the Mac developer community, because all of these people, I respect all of them, or there's a couple I actually not familiar with.
You have no respect for some of them.
No, I mean they're all great, and some of them I've used their code. I mean, I've used Matt's code a bunch, and I've enjoyed listening to a few of these guys on Scotty's podcast, and talked with a few at WWDC. But it's the interesting part to me was that almost all of them are new Mac people. Like they represent sort of the Mac OS X, the new or the next side of things. It shows something about the community now, where like the old school Mac people from the Carbon and pre-Carbon days, just I don't know, there's not as many of them. Maybe
you know what it is. What it is the old Carbon people. They get no respect.
Maybe that's it.
No respect, especially from Manton Reese.
What? Nah.
There's my sexy cough coming back to for anybody who is missing my extremely compromised voice. It appears to be paying me a return visit. So
I guess it kind of gets to something someone said the other day or blogged or tweeted about, which is that the Mac's 25 years old now, and a third of that time has actually been a Mac OS X.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't know. It's kind of surprising.
Who was that? I saw that on Twitter.
I don't remember either.
Yeah, somebody I have no respect for.
No, it's a good lineup. That kind of stood out for some reason for me. But also, I think the conference right now is called MacDev 2009, I guess, MacDev Europe. But apparently, he has been asked to rename it. I don't know if it was by Apple or there was some problem with using Mac in the conference name. And so I think we should come up with a new name for him. I don't know. Do you have any ideas?
We're the ones who have flagrantly abused the core.
Oh yeah,
is core trademark?
No.
It's like Mick of McDonald's. Like you can't have like we couldn't have started McIntuition because McDonald's would have been on us.
Right, especially if we had like the Happy Meal logo or something. I say ours are temporary.
Yeah, right. Our temporary logo is the golden arches. I could see how Mac Developer Network as the name of the institution itself could be a problem. Do you think that they're asking him to change the whole thing?
I'm not sure. I don't know if it's just the conference or it wasn't clear. I mean, he tweeted about it, and I think a couple people were volunteering names, like NS Conference, I think was one.
Right.
Which stood out.
It does strike me as confusing because isn't there a thing like the Microsoft Developer Network? MSDN.
MSDN,
right?
Yeah.
So it sort of feels like it could be like the Apple version of that if you weren't sort of familiar with, you know, the fact that Apple calls its thing the Apple Developer Connection.
Yeah, I can see how someone would be confused.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's difficult to come up with something that doesn't have Mac in it, especially if it doesn't have, you know, something like Cocoa in it or some terminology from the APIs.
Well, that's why something like kind of arbitrary, like Wolf French's C4 conference, you know, C4, he had sort of a contrived explanation. I mean, you know, not to put it down or anything, but, you know, C4 sort of random, arbitrary, you know, not completely arbitrary, but just four words, adjectives or whatever, nouns that start with C.
Well, and it added to the whole mystery of the conference, right? Because he didn't reveal what it stood for until...
Yeah, right. But the lesson from that is if you pick something simple enough, you know, like a letter and a numeral, it almost doesn't matter. You know, you could call this, Scotty could call this the B5, you know, and it stands for bad ass
brave.
Oh, did I lose my clean tag? Oh no, no, punk ass. I meant Daniel Punk ass.
There you go.
Yeah, there it wasn't a profanity. It was just a Twitter handle. But yeah, anyway, it's kind of like one of those situations where if you pick the simpler name, you pick the more you can get away with it, like Apple Computer,
mm-hmm.
right?
Sure.
Like you didn't pigeonhole yourself if you're Apple Computer and you pick the name of a fruit as your company name. But what if they were like Homebrew Computer Nerds Computer Company?
Yeah, right.
Right. Or yeah, or even like Homebrew Computer, like.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, it kind of has connotations you don't want to live with.
Yep.
Speaking of trademarks and featured names and all that, I think it's time that we move on to the Q&A section of our podcast. And we used to call it the Q&A section. We ended up getting more and more Q&A after like none Q&A,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And so I think it's time we step it up a notch and kind of add some branding to the Q&A section. So because our primary audience is Mac developers and people who are sort of interested in Mac development and peeking behind the scenes of the Mac developer world, I've got a good idea for a name, the Mac Developer Connection.
Pretty good, yeah.
I don't think there's any problem with that, do you?
I don't see why we'd have a problem. I think it's just pushing a little bit. You know, we've already got the logo, though, and Apple never complains, so I think we should just take it to the next step.
We're so spoiled now. We have this list. I'm staring at this list in Google Docs here.
Mm-hmm.
And did you have any that you were particularly excited to start with?
Well, let's start with the easy ones, I think.
You mean easy ones like this one from Dan Benjamin?
Oh, no.
Guys, how can I make my podcast as good as yours?
Well, some secrets we just can't share, Dan. We've honed our skills over the last 9 months to a year, and I feel like everyone needs to go through that process to, I don't know.
Maybe it's real. Maybe it's Maybelline.
Well, let's start with Stephen Carson, who wrote us, actually it was a while back, I think, but we had it around and hadn't talked about it, and it was basically, how did you get started, and what books do you recommend? What things you wish you knew early on that, or things you wish you knew early on that now you've learned the hard way?
Right. Okay.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things there. One of the things, actually, I'll take that in the opposite order about things you wish you learned early on. There's a bunch, of course. I mean, you know, any developer is constantly learning new stuff. I think with Coco in particular, I wish I had taken a little bit more time to actually read the docs and go through, read maybe a couple books. My first exposure to Coco, I guess, was at WWDC, and I fooled around with a couple little apps before 10.0 was really ready. But the first time I really dove into it was porting a large Carbon app to Coco. And at that point, it was kind of like, can this be done? You know, how quickly can we move this old code to the new way of doing things? And so I really went as quickly as I could porting things. And in the process, I picked up some bad habits that late, you know, over years, you know, you sort of have to go back and relearn, do things a better way. So I think that would be, that's the thing that stands out. Even to this day, sometimes I'll be working on something and I fall into a sort of an old habit or old way of doing things where if I had just started from maybe a better position, I would have had a little bit of a smoother ride. But at the same time, I'm all about actually doing something quickly and being able to see the results. I hate churning on one thing for weeks or months without actually seeing anything. So it's sort of a balance everyone has to have about, you know, jumping in quickly and getting something up and running, but also making sure you take the time to do things right and to figure out where the frameworks can help you.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about, kind of having the 2020 hindsight, is perhaps, you know, impossible to avoid. So just to sort of answer the question, you know, the way I got started with Coco was I had not written really any application type code for, you know, in my career. And I was at Apple and had the great fortune of the company putting me through a introduction to Coco class with the famous Malcolm Crawford from Coco Dev mailing list. You probably recognize that name.
Cool.
But then, you know, it was just sort of a very baseline amount of information. And it's just one of those things where over the years, you just, I mean, if you're like me, you feel like you're a beginner forever. And then one day you kind of look around and say, you know, I still feel like a beginner, but I kind of know a bit about this. And, I have a similar feeling right now because I've been sort of getting more and more interested in Python, especially for automating things. I've been working on improving my build process and, you know, automating backups and things like that. And I realize as I'm learning how to do these things with Python that I'm doing some of the same patterns of just, you know, you sort of like look at a problem and you think, well, what's the right way to solve this? And you can go searching for hours or days for the right way to solve something. And eventually you just settle on, you know, a way to solve something.
Right.
And I think that that's true for most learning experiences with programming type stuff, especially because, I mean, even with something like Coco, where, as you said, you could have read more books, you could have read more documentation, but I think all good developers end up having strong opinions about certain things, about how things should be done. And it's unusual for all of those opinions to match what you read in a book or in documentation. I would say my advice for anybody who wants to get started is to just get started however you can and get something going. And, you know, give yourself a context in which to develop your own, you know, knowledge about what's right and what's wrong. Of course, there's some things like memory management, if you're not using garbage collection, that you sort of just have to read and understand and go with it and accept it. But other things, I really think there's still a lot of room for personal decisions about how to best handle architecture of your apps and which technologies from Apple you want to use or avoid.
Yeah, that's definitely true. macOS 10 development is kind of interesting because you can go years without touching a whole bunch of important APIs. So, I mean, you could build a couple really successful apps and never do anything with QuickTime, for example.
Right.
You know, you're a great Mac developer. Maybe you've been developing for 5-10 years or longer, but there's these things you've never needed to touch. And then when you get around to, you know, needing to do them, then you can become an expert in them. And maybe the thing to do is definitely just do, I mean, get something working, absolutely, but also look for places a year later or a couple years later where you can say, okay, this API is new to me. I'm going to take a little bit of time to sort of dive into it a little deeper than I maybe did when I was first getting started.
I gave a sort of high level non-answer. And to correct that somewhat, I would like to say that as far as books go, definitely check out Aaron Hillegass's book, especially for total beginners. I often recommend Mark Dalrymple's Learn Objective-C on the Mac. And he just has a new version that came out of that one, so it's probably up to date with lots of groovy new Objective-C 2.0 stuff. Just a kind of quick rundown of some things that are available. There is a lot of good stuff out there on the blogs. Just find a good Coco blog. Like there's a fairly new one, Coco with Love. If you search on Coco with Love in Google, I'm sure you'll get to it. Matt Gallagher's blog. Theo Cacao. What's Scott Stevenson's? What's the name of the Coco blog?
Well, there's that. That's his personal blog where he does Coco stuff. And then he also has CocoBlogs.com.
Oh, right, yeah.
That hasn't been updated in a while, but that was nice for a while because it sort of pointed to a lot of different people blogging about Coco. So that was a nice place to start, too.
It's still a good start. And so what I would recommend is clicking on several of those blogs and see where their links follow. And they find a lot of valuable stuff in the Coco bloggers area. You know, there's some common mailing lists that a bunch of us are on. Coco Dev from Apple is a good resource, albeit a little noisy. And that Mac SB mailing list I mentioned earlier is good for the business side of things to sort of touch base with other developers there's the nice thing about that list is there are people at sort of every point on the continuum of starting out and, you know, old timers who are sort of established and successful.
That's a great list. I don't subscribe to Coco Dev anymore. I haven't for a while, but I still read the archives a lot. If I'm searching for something, I'll sort of see where Google takes me, and then I'll sort of branch out either go into some of the CocoDev archives or go into like cocodev.org and sort of explore around that way.
Okay, well, we have another question from listener Fulker Moore. What do you do for a living? I doubt your products are enough to keep your families warm and well-fed.
Oh, ouch.
Ouch! Really? Yeah, if you read that literally, it sounds like he thinks our products are not valuable enough to earn us a living. But I think I know where he's coming from, which is just to say that, you know, in general, it's easy to be skeptical about the ability of a one person or a small number of people starting a small company and actually getting enough products moving to customers to make a living. I myself was and sometimes continue to be skeptical about that. But, you know, the good news is for me personally, this is what I do for a living for the time being. The past few years, it's been working itself out. I've stopped doing consulting completely. So that's been sort of a big victory for me to be able to take that element of the sustenance out of the equation and sort of just be able to focus on continuing to develop my company's apps. I know that that's a big problem for people is when they're getting started with this, how do you transition from an idea to a marketable product to marketing that product enough to make a living? There's just so many ways that you can screw it up along the way. No offense to most developers, but I have made the same mistakes. So I'm not discounting myself, but most developers are not good at designing products or at actually looking honestly at what makes a saleable product, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So a lot of developers left to their own devices will come up with something that's incredibly cool by some standard.
Mm-hmm.
And usually that standard is it's really cool to show off with your developer buddies. Look at this thing. You know, all you do is you go to the command line and you use curl to download this this Flickr stream and pipe it into this Apple script and then pipe the results of that out into a text file on the desktop where you can easily search and replace through all of the fields and pretty soon you've got your homepage. You know, that's an exaggeration, but a lot of the problem, I think, with getting started and making a successful product, you know, I know some people are thinking, well, what do you know? You acquired your product. You know, I get that a lot, and it's slightly irritating. But the fact is that it's also hard even just to maintain a product's momentum. Mm-hmm. So even if you end up with a successful product, there's this sort of, what is that when, you know, things are always falling apart and getting less organized?
That's just every day. I don't know.
There's a scientific term for this. Entropy, right?
Okay.
I don't know. I made that word up.
Yeah.
if I used it wrong, then I'm sorry. Don't hate me, scientists. But applications, products, they're hard to keep, you know, in good health.
And you have to keep them in good health, right? Or you'll see your sales slowly dwindle. You have to keep at it. You have to keep marketing. You have to keep having new versions. There's no way to release the perfect software and then just retire to the beach and live off the money without any, you know, involvement on your part. It just doesn't happen.
Right. Anyway, to answer your question, I do this for a living and it is somewhat challenging to sort of get products to a degree of success and maintenance to make a living off of them, but it is possible. So I'd like to encourage people to pursue that dream. For me personally, it has involved, as I said, sort of trying to develop my own senses of what makes a successful product. You know, how do you run a business so that customers have faith in you, are confident in your ability to support them? How do you promote the marketing angles of your business? There's just so much to do with it that has little relation to the programming aspect that if I had to give anybody advice about going from, you know, the dream to reality, I would say be prepared to learn all of the other skills, or at least a small amount of every other skill you will need to, not to be a good programmer, but to be a good, adequate business runner.
Yeah, for my stuff, this is kind of interesting. I don't support my family and keep them well fed solely on my independent projects. Although it's a good source of revenue, it's not my only source because I could not keep them well fed on just that, unfortunately, right now. I'm at a funny point, and I found a quote. I was reading someone's blog a couple weeks ago, Rob Walling, who I guess the blog is popular, but I hadn't read it before. And he was talking about the software product myth, which is exactly what you're saying about all the extra stuff that comes with running a business. And he said, basically, at some point, every developer reaches this point where they have not enough sales to match what a full salary would be at a sort of normal job, but way too many sales to just be able to work on it on the weekends, right? You can't support yourself from it fully, but it's still a full-time job. And I think everyone probably hits this, and you have to make a choice. Are you going to give up kind of and say, this is just, I can't work two jobs anymore. I'm just going to go back to getting a normal salary. Or are you going to push through that dip, you know, and say, I'm just going to make it work.
Right.
I don't know. I imagine everyone goes through that. I'm sure there's some cases where people get lucky in that they very quickly can ramp up to what would be comparable at a regular job. But I have been writing Mac software professionally for a while, most recently for a company called VitalSource doing ebook software. So that helps feed the family too.
One of the things I think is it came up for me listening to what you were saying about the, you know, all the other stuff that's involved is kind of one of the unfortunate mixes of demands from running your own software business is you have to kind of have a huge ego, right? Yeah. And you kind of have to have no ego because you need to be. I've noticed this a lot. There's people who I think will never succeed because they have not enough ego. They don't have enough confidence in themselves to follow through on a plan and to bring a product to completion. But on the flip side of that, you run into these people who are so confident in their view of the world and you know, like you have to be able to say, okay, I'm not a very good marketer right now, right? Or okay, I'm not a very good designer. I'm not a very good. I don't really understand what customers want. I don't really know what makes a thrilling user experience. That's kind of. It's always kind of hard to admit that, you know, when you are looking at something and you say, and you have a strong opinion about it and you say, oh, I'm sure this is the right way to do it. Sometimes you have to take a step back and say, well, I can be as sure of this as I want to, but if I go out and look on the web, everybody else in the world seems to be saying, you know, they want the opposite from what I think is right.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a challenge just to be simultaneously strong and maybe sort of defensive of what you hold to be true, but also occasionally at least able to admit defeat or admit that you might not actually understand the situation well enough to continue executing on it. I seem to recall sometime in the distant past you were working on an app or something.
Oh yeah, I've given that up.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's just as we were saying, you know, determination, confidence, ego, all of these things are important.
And I keep my family warm just by running compiles 24/7 with the Mac Pro.
Yeah.
I need to just get a Mac Pro for every room and do distributed builds, and then that'll be the heat generator.
Just ask your daughters to hold a MacBook Pro and they will be warm all winter long.
Exactly. They'd probably be fine with that since that was at the top of their Christmas list that they did not receive.
So you were going to try to get by on this episode without mentioning your app. Let me guess, because you have not done anything.
Well, not done anything would be a stretch. I've actually worked on it a bunch over the weekend and I actually put out the first new beta actually in a few weeks. It has a bunch of stuff. It has all the things that I wasn't going to do for 1.0. That
Speaking of lessons, right?
Exactly. You know, I've talked before about how I was trying to really go out of my way to not put a lot of things that users want in 1.0. And that sounds sort of, you know, like I don't care about what customers want, which isn't true. But I just was trying to keep the 1.0 really bare bones. But I backpedaled on that a little bit and ended up putting a few things in that really needed to be there.
You took my suggestion to put a Twitter client in?
Oh, yeah. It's there. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, good. Okay, good. Yeah, I'll buy it then. Yeah.
Just need to do that last push, you know, to 1.0.
That's the hardest part, of course, as any of us who have shipped to 1.0 know, but it sure does feel good when you get done. I remember, you know, in particular with FlexTime, because I was, you know, doing that one from scratch to 1.0. And when I got towards the end, probably around where you are now, it was just got to be so painful to fix. Even the littlest bug started to be like, I just wanted to get this thing done.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, though, like the minute practically that I committed and tagged and called it 1.0 and released it, just practically the minute that happened, I was completely reinvigorated again and started fixing all these issues. Oh, yeah. And adding all these features that that I had found too painful to do.
Yeah.
For 1.0. So I'm sure that once you get this out the door, you will be not only will you have a resurgence of energy, but the response from users is always really inspiring, and you know, real users, not beta testers. Mm-hmm. Right.
Absolutely.
Because it's not to diminish what beta testers do for us, but it's just like, you know, you get it out there and somebody who has no reason really to care about what you're working on downloads your app and tries it. And that's just really, really a cool feedback mechanism for software.
I agree completely. And I feel like that first time that you get real paying customers, you know, it's important to distinguish between users and customers. I mean, when people actually go out of their way to pay for your software, and then, you know, maybe they send feedback, maybe they don't, but just when you get that notification that sales are coming in, it's just very energizing in a way that releasing, I think, freeware or working on commercial software for someone else where you're not directly involved in the sales channel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just a different experience. And it definitely, I know that's going to happen, and I just have to sort of push forward with it. I feel the same way actually with just bug fix releases. Like, there's this problem of if I work on a couple bugs and then I let it sit and I don't release it.
Yeah.
As a bug fix release, and they start sort of piling up, there's this problem that you're talking about of it just becomes, the longer that goes, the harder it becomes to actually wrap that up and ship it.
Well, I wish you luck, Manton. I think you're getting close.
Great. Thanks. All right. Well, we'll talk again, maybe in another 2 weeks.
That sounds good. Let's aim for trying to keep it around that and see how that goes.
Cool. All right. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.